Welcome back to Talk Talk Nation. I'm your host, Joe Weber, and sitting with me in the office right now, you may know him as Super Fast Matt. I got Matt Brown. Thank you so much for being in the office with us today for Talk Talk Nation. You are pretty close to us, right? You're in Torrance?
Pretty close.
Yeah. Not too far. For anyone uninitiated, Matt's got a YouTube channel called Super Fast Matt. It's close to 700,000 subscribers right now.
Just about, yeah.
Cool. And he does amazing projects, you know, like from an off-road Viper to a Tesla swapped Jaguar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you also do land speed stuff, which is really cool, which is why we called you a while ago to help us with our 100 MPG drag Mustang video, which was such a stupid idea. Our creative director was pitching that for years, and we're like, come on, dude, that's stupid. And it's like, it just passed a million views right now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So you are what I would call an aerodynamics expert, but you kind of butt with the term expert, right?
Yeah. I don't know if I'm an expert. I know a lot about aerodynamics, about some parts of aerodynamics. It's like anytime you learn about something like aero, you realize that like the further you get into it, the more you realize there's so much you don't know.
Yeah.
And so I'm definitely in that part where I'm like, oh, I know a lot about this part of it, but man, it's a big area. So.
Yeah. Just recently, because the World Cup has been on, they were talking about this ball that they used, I think in the 2010 World Cup, that like everyone hated because it, just the way that they set it up, turned everything into kind of a knuckleball. Like it would find these crazy, like, pockets of air and just make absurd movements.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the goalkeepers were like, this ball. but I've always been interested in aerodynamics from like a, you know, outside perspective. And your body kits have always been, you know, interesting to me. And the Bernoulli effect with, you know, watching F1 is super crazy. I've always thought, how do you get into that kind of stuff?
So yeah, like I was a professional engineer for about 15 years. So like I was never an aerodynamicist, but I worked with the aerodynamics guys quite a bit. So you would kind of like pick up things here and there. And then I did with Formula SAE in college, building the race car.
That's right. You were telling me about this.
Yeah, I did the sort of a lot of the work on the aero for that.
And you were also a judge?
Yeah. So back, I did the program as a student 20 years ago now, a long time ago. And then I've been back as a volunteer a few times as a judge.
Cool.
Help out with the program.
Judging these SAE competitions, what does that look like?
It's very interesting because there's... So Formula SAE, for people who don't know, is a bunch of students at a bunch of different universities get together and build a small formula style race car. And then they compete against each other in dynamic events and then some static events like design judging. And it's absolutely fantastic for teaching engineers how to be engineers. It's like, we kind of have this problem in universities where you learn a lot of theory and you learn a lot of like hard math, but you don't really learn how to actually build things, how to actually design, engineer, and create things. And Formula SAE is really, really good at sort of filling in all that gap.
Super hands-on.
So, the students build these cars, they go out to these competitions, and then, you know, there's the dynamic events where they drive around a course. They have sort of like acceleration and skid pad, and then autocross type events. And then there's the design event where they sort of present their engineering to people, to experts in the industry, and me. And we sort of like... sort of rank them, judge them, and give them feedback to try to like help them improve.
And how do you judge that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, there's probably 100 judges. I don't think there's that many. There's a lot of judges. So a bunch of different people from a bunch of different fields, and everybody's got their own expertise, right? So everybody's kind of like, hey, I know a lot about this. I'm going to ask the students about this. I particularly like to ask about process and about like the sort of high level, like, okay, show me, what are your goals? We start with the goals. And then how did you reach your goals? And then prove to me that the design that you have, you know, is the best to meet those goals. And, you know, if you're a student at a university and you got a year to build a car, the cars are really complex. You also have full-time school going on. So it's like, it's a lot to ask. So it's pretty rare that anybody's done it exactly the right way. So you can kind of like find the gaps. And then, you know, at the end of the, you know, the next day you can go up and be like, hey, you guys need to fill in here, here, and here. Otherwise you did great, whatever. Give them feedback and they're hopefully the next year they can do better. Or if they're graduating, they can go into, get a job and do, build great things.
Be a real engineer.
Yeah.
Have you been doing this for a while?
I've only volunteered 3 times. So on and off here and there. I've had in my work in progress folder, I've had a Formula SE video that's been half done for years. And I think part of it is like, I have trouble finishing it because I don't know if I'm doing it justice. Because it's sort of hard to overstate how much that program has shaped my career and my life, and the careers and lives of so many people that I know. So I think I'm a little afraid to fuck it up, but.
There's no video on your channel where I'm like, this is a stinker. I feel like you could put whatever SAE video out and it'd be interesting. You'd find a way to make it interesting.
Yeah, I'll finish it one of these days. Yeah. Maybe actually pretty soon.
So your channel's inching up on about 700,000 subscribers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would put you in a bin that I would call like dudes who are too fucking smart that have too much creativity. Like you and Confers are on par.
Oh, thanks.
In my mind, yeah. Where like you guys, I'm always like, how did you come up with that shit? Like that's insane. And then you execute it so well. Have you run into any challenges where like you've bitten off more than you can chew and you're like, how am I going to finish this build or how am I going to finish this video?
No, because there's not really a deadline.
Yeah.
I mean, the cool thing about working for myself is like, I quit a pretty successful engineering career to do YouTube.
So you're full-time YouTube right now?
Full-time YouTube.
Wow.
So if it's not fun, it has to be fun.
Yeah.
So as soon as it stops being fun, I bake in some breaks and stretch it out and figure it out, you know. So it's like there are projects like the Land Speed Car. I have friends that help me, but I'm kind of a one-man show. On the videos, I do everything. I really like doing everything. I think a lot of creators kind of want to like outsource editing and stuff like that.
So you edit all your videos?
I edit too. All my videos. Wow. I like that part. But they always take longer than I think they will.
Yeah.
Which I think is probably a good thing, because if I knew how long some of them would take, I probably wouldn't start them. But like the Land Speed Car is taking, it's just, I swapped the engine. So last year I broke the record for the 1 liter non-turbocharged. I have the world's fastest non-turbocharged 1 liter and the world's fastest non-turbocharged half liter car.
Hell yeah. That's the Streamliner one that you, yeah. The white with the stickers on the back.
Yeah. So this year I was like, all right, it's very narrow. It's very small. You're not going to fit anything bigger than a motorcycle engine in it. So I was like, well, what's the fastest I could go with this car? And the easiest way to make horsepower with a motorcycle engine is a Hayabusa. It's a solved problem. The technology is 25 years old, but it's still like you can go add to cart and get any like, so I rebuilt this Hayabusa engine, stroked it out to 1.5. It should make about 700, maybe 750 horsepower.
No way.
Yeah. And so like the only Suzuki parts left are like a few castings and some washers. It's like everything is beefed up afterwards.
That's crazy.
So I've got that in there and I thought like, okay, turbocharged engine swap is going to take some time, but it has been pretty much most of what I've done for the last 9 months. And I got a little burnt out on it actually a few weeks ago. I took it to the dyno and we turned the clutch into glitter, just completely fried the clutch.
I saw that. But
and I was like, I need a break. And thankfully I had a vacation with some friends lined up. So I got to leave the country for a couple of weeks. And
where'd you go?
We went to Switzerland.
We rode around
the Swiss Alps and the Italian Alps.
Yeah. And the gondolas and stuff.
Yeah. Like yeah. Yeah. It was pretty cool. It's pretty fun.
I've heard that they have like honor system cheese huts where there's just local farmers fill these little huts full of cheese. And there's a little like donation bin. You go and grab your fresh cheese. That sounds like heaven.
I didn't see that, but I do believe it. It's a very, the country is, the Swiss have figured something out.
Watches.
There's a lot of trust there because everybody is trustworthy. There's a lot of like, everybody's really nice. It's a little odd that like, you follow the rules. If you're Swiss, you follow the rules, and there are a lot of rules.
Maybe they got that from the Germans.
Maybe. But we were on the Italian side, and man, you go across the border, and all of a sudden, it's like rules don't exist. It's weird so riding funny. A motorcycle, because technically, you're not supposed to split lanes in either country. It's technically illegal in both countries. Nobody does it in Switzerland. Yeah. Everybody does it. It's like as soon as you cross the border, you just like pull the wheel up and start doing the hand emoji. Yeah.
We went to Italy a couple times when I was a kid, just because my family's from there, and we were like trying to figure out where my grandpa was born. And I remember just feeling helpless, because like red lights were just suggestions.
Yeah.
People were going crazy, like flipping you off, whatever, doing on mopeds, taking their hands off to like do, you know, the Italian signals.
Yeah.
And then we just drove past a dog that was on fire, like a dead dog. And we're like, this is crazy.
Wow. Jesus.
But I want to go back so bad. I want to go to Switzerland. I want to do, you know, like Bruges, do a little kind of mini tour and end up at the Nürburgring. That's my dream.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we mostly were just motorcycling across the passes. Mm.
What kind of bike did you have?
I rented a MB Agusta Turismo Veloce R.
Oh, that's cool.
Because I was like, Italian Alps, look at an Italian bike.
Yeah.
Not a great bike.
Really?
Yeah. I was perfectly fine for the trip, but it's MB Agusta, I think they lean pretty hard on the good styling.
And yeah.
They're not trying too hard with the engineering.
Do you think the altitude made it perform worse?
Yeah, for sure. But like, I think it's like the clutch was clunky. The transmission was not great. The power band, it has a lot of power, but it's like, there's not like area under the curve. It's like really peaky at the top.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't all bad, but, I think it actually would be a great bike if it cost like 2/3 what it costs, but it's a very expensive bike.
Yeah.
But yeah, you haven't been to the Nürburgring?
Never. Yeah, I've only been to Paris and Italy, but yeah, I want to go to Nürburgring. You've been before?
I did a bunch of years ago. It's very cool. It's very cool that even exists.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. We rented, me and a friend were there, and he owned a Lotus Esprit at the time, or Lotus Elise at the time. And we went to the rental place, and they're like, we'll give you a Renault Clio. I want a Renault Clio. Come on. So we went to another place that had a Lotus, so we got the Lotus.
Yeah.
And then we drove around the track and then proceeded to get passed by Renault Clios left and right. They have like a lot of Clios that are, you know, big brakes and
just, yeah,
you know, like outfitted for that.
That's got to be like the Miata of
Germany. So. Yeah. Yeah. But it's a blast. That's fun. Check it out.
If you were to go back, what car would you rent?
I mean, it doesn't really matter, because like you're going to be passed by people left and right.
Yeah.
I think, you know, something like a GT3 would be great, but like, do you really need to be going that fast and spending that kind of money?
I wouldn't trust myself with a GT3.
Yeah. I honestly, I think if you took a Renault Clio, you'd have as much fun as anything
else. Just pin it the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just have a blast.
That's, yeah. Driving slow cars is very fun.
I'm a big fan of slow car fast.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you start out with slow cars, and then you grow up, and you think, like, I think the progression is naturally towards like more expensive and faster.
Yeah.
And at some point I turned around and went back the other way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very mature, and it's something you need to like experience too, mm-hmm. where if you don't have the opportunity to have, you know, drive a 800 horsepower, ridiculous, you know, hypercar, whatever, you don't know that you can't even control that much. You know, it's like a kind of immature mindset to be like, I need this much power to have fun. It's like, no, you don't.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting with motorcycles too, because I feel like motorcycles went off the deep end like 20 years ago. And the amount of power that you can get out of a bike is, even 20 years ago, was like well beyond what even like unless you're a professional motorcycle rider, it's way more than you need. And cars have gotten that way too. They're usually, there's a little bit of a filter because those cars are generally more expensive, but
No one needs a Hayabusa.
No. I mean, I need a Hayabusa to go really fast in a straight line, but
yeah. Speaking of builds on your channel, you have a bunch of, I'd say, very eclectic builds. How did you come up with some of these, like the off-road Viper, what went through your mind to be like, I think I'm going to take this Viper off-road?
I mean, the Viper, that's the car I had on the wall when I was a kid. The poster is the red RT10 Viper. And I bought one maybe 10 years ago, and it's not very good. It's not a very good car. I always say the Viper is a great car, but it's not a good car.
Was that second gen?
A second gen. Okay, yeah, I've owned two of them. They've both been second gen. It's first gen. I think some people split it up differently, but the first gen and second gen are basically the same car. It's just the second gen. They came out with the coupe and then also added some air conditioning and some other windows that actually roll down. But so I bought the first one and I drove it around and it was like, the looks don't disappoint. The burnouts don't disappoint. Everything else, pretty disappointing. But I thought, all right, so it looks awesome. It sounds great. It's got a huge engine and it does wicked burnouts. How do you crank that up to 11?
Yeah.
It's already at 11. How do you crank that up to 12? You're like, oh, you lift it 10 inches, put some off-road tires on it. So, I started doing some CAD works, doing some design work to see what I could make it look like. It looked pretty awesome.
Yeah. So, it does look so sick.
Yeah. And the Vipers are not too expensive. I think you can get a good, decent second gen one for about 40 grand. That's what I paid for mine.
Yeah.
Certainly not cheap, but it's like my favorite thing to do with that car is to take it to a car show and park it next to like the row of Ferraris and McLarens.
Yeah.
Cause people will walk past $20 million worth of cars and not even look at them to go look at my old Dodge. It's hilarious. But yeah, it's a blast. So the idea was, you know, I didn't want to do the thing where you take a body of a car and stick it on a truck chassis. Yeah. I wanted it to be Viper. Mm-hmm. That's usually the first question people ask is, does it still have the V10? Yeah, it still has a V10. It's all Viper except the suspension and the bumpers that I made. But I wanted to make it like a proper off-roading vehicle where you could actually take it off-road, sure, hit some jumps, hit some whoops and stuff like that.
It seems like it would be pretty capable.
So every time I've taken it off-road, all the stuff that I did works great.
Yeah.
All the Dodge stuff, not so much, which is not to shit on Dodge because it was never designed for that sort of stuff. But like the hood is like everything rattles and squeaks and it's to the point where like the hood will rattle around and bang into the fenders and the front fascia and like chip paint off and paint is cracking. And so my plan was like, I'll just take it off road and I'll drive it around and then I'll take it back and everything that's broken, I'll fix and upgrade. And then I'll do that 5 or 6 times and it'll be a great off-road car. But I've kind of gotten to the point where I'm like, it's never going to be a great off-road car. It's going to be I'll take it off-road and it's kind of fun as long as you like, don't really, cause I was hammering it through the sand. I took it to King of Hammers and you've been there, King of Hammers?
Yeah, I've never been. So, I know what it is
though. Yeah. So it's like a bunch of like desert rednecks. It's just a
sea. It seems like the perfect car for that.
It was the spiritual home of the Vipers. Yeah. It was so cool because I would, you know, there would be a row of 100 people watching a race, watching trophy trucks fly by. And I would just like come around a corner and drive behind them with the Viper. And every single person would like turn around and grab their phone and be like, oh my God, that's take a video. Yeah. It was the coolest car out there. It was a great to be out there.
Did you trailer it there or did you drive
it? Oh, I trailered it there, yeah. But we were, me and some friends with a couple of friends who had Raptors and I was like following them in the desert, just going, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles an hour and slammed into a rock that messed up the front, one of the control arms pretty bad. Shit. Got cracked paint and chipped and I was just like, I gotta stop doing this. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn. That sounds so fun. So you got your Viper. You also have this Tesla swapped Jaguar. What year is it?
50.
1950.
Yeah. Mark V.
Mark V. Okay.
Yeah. So the Mark V. So Jag, before World War II, it wasn't even called Jaguar. It was called SS. Mm-hmm. They changed the name because SS had negative connotations after World War II.
You don't say.
Yeah. Jag had, they kind of just copied Bentley's designs. So the Mark V is essentially a Bentley Mark VI,
okay,
I think, or Mark IV. Basically exactly copy. And then like, if you look back through Jag's designs backwards, they're kind of just all Bentley copies.
That's so funny.
But then the Mark V was debuted, I think it was the same day as the XK120.
That's
the XK120 is an awesome car.
Yeah.
It was the fastest car in the world for a time.
Yep.
It looks beautiful, has an awesome engine. And then the Mark V was just kind of like this sad little look next to it. So that nobody cares about the Mark V. So I found one. I like it because it's like, it's like a 1930s design.
Yeah.
But it came out in 1950, big swooping fenders. Yeah. So I got one and I swapped the Tesla drivetrain into it. Thought it'd be a good platform for it because the engine was crap anyway. It had like 83 horsepower.
Yeah.
The the components on this car, I cannot believe how heavy. I dropped like 300 or 400 pounds of weight.
By putting batteries in it?
Put a 1,000 pound battery in it. It still lowered the weight of the car. The engine was so heavy. The starter motor must have been made of lead. It was so heavy. That's Every crazy. Time I pick something up, my brain would be like, no, this is what? Not supposed to be this heavy. But yeah, lined it up. The plan with that was to kind of make it into a daily driver.
Yeah.
But I got it to, it's mostly done. And every time I drive it, I'm like, I'm going to die in this thing. And there's Is no it too safety. Fast? It's not too fast. It's just like, it's a tin can.
Yeah.
And it has lap belts because the seats I put in were lap belts, but I didn't have any seat belts. Obviously, there's no airbags or crumple zones or anything. And the visibility is really bad. So every time I drive it, I feel like I'm going to die. So I tend not to drive it very often.
Did you, so you didn't just kind of take the body and put it on a Tesla chassis, right? You fully kind of integrated the battery and.
Yeah. Yeah. So I pulled the body off and then I took the frame and I sort of made a little container for the Tesla battery between the frame rails. And then I put the it's called the penthouse. It's part of the battery that's got like all the charging electronics and everything. I put that in the trunk. And then I use the entire rear subframe from a Model 3 or Model Y, okay. Whatever. So it's got all the suspension and everything.
So that's probably more comfortable than it would have been.
Suspension-wise? Yeah. I mean, I think like the suspension is decent. I upgraded the front suspension too. It's got a low center of mass. I've taken it in the canyons a few times and it's like, it's a fun little sporty car.
Sounds fun.
But it's just dangerous.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have air conditioning and it's kind of noisy, so.
As you built it, was there ever a point where you're like, this is way more complicated than I thought? Or did you go into it knowing it was going to be a ton of work?
I mean, I always underestimate how much work projects are going to be, but that one wasn't too much more complicated than I thought. The thing that worried me about that is like, I'm a mechanical engineer. I used to work for Tesla, but I never worked on the powertrain stuff. So the electric motor stuff and the power electronics and all that, it's sort of a black box for me. And so as long as I can find somebody and give them money and they like interact with the black box, which is what I do. There's a couple of companies that will sell you a controller to where you can plug it into the drive unit and then just select drive, neutral, park, reverse.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I did. So that's that stuff's cool. Been working.
Yeah.
But yeah, the rest of it's pretty straightforward. I don't know that cars are so complicated these days. Like the correct way to do it would be like, all right, you buy it. So if you got an internal combustion engine, you need a heat exchanger for it, right? You need a radiator. So you buy a radiator that's about the right size. You throw a fan on it. You check your temperatures. You try to keep it below 210 or whatever. With the electric drivetrain, everything's liquid goes like the battery is liquid cooled, the motor, the inverter, and you can reach into the CAN bus and get temperatures for a bunch of stuff. But like, I don't know what they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I just have like a radiator with coolant running through everything constantly.
Didn't you say that was your job at Tesla?
It was. Yeah. More on the integration packaging side, yeah. But, yeah. So I don't know. It works.
Yeah.
It's not like optimized.
You've never hit the limit as far as, you know, like temperature or, whatever. Battery coolant needs.
Yeah. Which I mean, it never would. Cause it's like, I'm not stretching out I suppose if I like took it on some road trips through the desert with a bunch of people in it or whatever, but like, it's not the kind of car it is.
Do you think you could do that? Is the range that high?
So the range is actually pretty bad. I use the medium battery, whatever the standard range or whatever. And I kind of wish I would have used the long range because it would have cost me a little bit more money, but the package was the same size.
What is the difference between those batteries?
So the modules, they changed it after I started doing this where the modules are actually half the size or some percentage of the size. But when I bought mine, they used the same size module. They just didn't populate all of the cells.
Oh, okay.
So it's just missing some of the cells. So physically, it's the same size, but the thing is, like, in a Tesla, you get, 200 and some odd miles out of it. But the aerodynamics of a 1950 Jaguar are atrocious. I did a video on this where you actually do a computer analysis on it backwards, and it's more aerodynamically efficient backwards. Even if you, like, add heat exchangers and headlights to the rear. Like, it's so bad.
Really?
Yeah.
It's so funny because during that period, they probably thought they were like really cooking with the aerodynamics.
It looks
like,
aerodynamic.
This looks like a plane.
Yeah. It's so bad though. It's like, I mean, generally with aerodynamics, with drag, if you want to minimize drag, you want like just like kind of rounded edges in the front and sharp edges in the back. It's sort of the exact opposite of that. anyway, I get maybe like, it also really depends on how you drive it, but I get maybe like 100 miles out of it. So it's about half of what it was in the Tesla. Which, you know, as long as you're paying attention, it's fine.
Is it on like period correct tires and stuff, like old bias ply?
No, it's on Tesla wheels and tires.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's way better.
Yeah.
I would not take a bias ply tires into the canyons.
No. Kind of, it's fun to take it places because it's silent and, you know, I'll pull into a car meet and people are like, they see the Tesla wheels and, you know, the turbine wheels. Why do they got put Tesla wheels on this? Why is it silent? Oh, yeah. Put two and two together.
Yeah.
Checking Allstate First could save you hundreds on car insurance. Not checking your fuel levels before driving off the grid on your road trip? Not good. You're out of gas and you're stuck on the side of the road. Great way to start off the trip. Yeah, checking first is a good idea. So check Allstate First for an auto quote. It could save you hundreds. And for fast, reliable help when you need it, add an Allstate roadside plan today. You're in good hands with Allstate. Potential savings vary, subject to terms and availability. Insurance by Allstate North American Insurance Company, Northbrook, Illinois. Roadside assistance by Allstate Motor Club, Incorporated, an Allstate affiliate.
So what are your plans for the next build? Can you divulge anything?
I don't know. I'm so deep in the land speed thing that I kind of want to see where that goes.
Yeah.
I have some ideas. I'd kind of like to build an airplane.
Whoa.
But I'd probably do a kit plane. Because I know enough about engineering to know that I will kill myself if I build an airplane from scratch. But I kind of like the idea of doing that because it's different. Because normally when I build something, I sort of shoot from the hip a lot. I kind of like take some guesses, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. I just rebuild it. You can't really do that with a plane. You can do it once. So I think it'd be fun to build a kit, but that doesn't really make for good YouTube because it's like if I make a video where like I got these parts and I follow the instructions.
Plug and play. Yeah.
So I kind of have some ideas around that on sort of like leaning a little bit hard on sort of, learning and teaching engineering fundamentals around it, or talking about engineering, what I think is interesting. Because I graduated college basically 20 years ago, and I've forgotten more than like so much. And it would be nice to go back through and like relearn. Because there's a lot of really interesting, like actually super interesting things about engineering.
Probably so many more developments too.
And probably a lot's changed, yeah. There's a lot of really not very interesting things, but I think it'd be cool to like go in and remember like all the interesting stuff and sort of like intersperse that through. But I don't know. I also kind of want to get, so I bought a Pontiac Fiero recently.
Oh, sick.
I love the Fiero.
Yeah, me too.
I kind of love that everybody hates it too, but it's like, it's such a weird, just freaking weird car.
Very weird.
Weird that it even exists. But I bought it and I thought about doing a Tesla swap into it.
That'd be very fun. It'd almost be like a, because the Iron Duke is so bad.
Oh yeah.
Like there's no point in like, you know, trying to make that better at all.
Yeah. Just throw that in the trash.
I think it'd also be fun to put like an MR2 engine in it. An American MR2. But Tesla swap would be fun because just imagine like that super tiny wheelbase with a really low center of gravity, that's so fun.
Yeah. And there would be a challenge trying to pack all the batteries in there, but I think with the battery technology improving, I think it's doable. But I bought a Fiero and drove it around, and I think I'm probably not going to do that.
No.
I like it. It's fun the way it is, but I'm like, I don't know. The thing is like, all right, if I buy a Fiero for $4,000 and through whatever, depending on the condition, and then I throw $20,000 worth of like electric powertrain into it, it's still going to be worth $4,000.
Sure. But you can't look at it like that. You're like, as far, if you're in the YouTube sphere, like that thing's worth $1 million. It just depends on how you know, make videos out of it and package it and stuff like that. You can make your money back. It's fine.
Yeah. I think I'm going to probably not do it. I might, I might buy a Lotus Esprit and do it with that. Cause I think that's, that's still a sort of not too expensive. It looks like a supercar.
Yeah.
There are versions of it that have a pretty low power kind of bad electronics. You can get it for pretty cheap.
What era? Because they made it for a while, right?
Yeah. I actually like all of them. So I wouldn't really be too picky about it. Just looking for the right one.
Sure. You could buy Elon's.
Yeah, the James Bond one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was at work at Tesla when that got delivered. That was a surreal
thing. No way.
Yeah.
Whoa.
We're like working on something. I don't even remember what, but like we had to take delivery of Elon's car because SpaceX was busy trying to launch something into orbit.
So you guys are basically his concierge.
yeah, kind of. But I think a Lotus Esprit is such a cool car.
Yeah.
And there are versions that don't have a lot of power and don't have a great engine. And I think if you shoved, I think the key to doing that really well would be you get like a Model 3 or Model Y all-wheel drive and you get the front and rear motor.
Yeah.
And then you figure out how to package the batteries in there and then you get 500 horsepower all-wheel drive electric Lotus Esprit.
That's very fun.
I think it'd be cool. It'd be sort of difficult to do in the front because of the way the frame is. They have like a weird I-beam frame kind of thing.
Oh, really? What kind of suspension on it?
I think it's just double wishbone.
Just double wishbone.
Yeah. But that would be a big tear up on the suspension and drivetrain. But it'd be fun. Be a good project.
That's super fun.
Yeah.
That's
but I have like, I could do this for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
You hold like build random stuff on you. I have so many ideas.
Do you like, cause rarely we were talking about like engineers versus designers before. That's very much like left brain, right brain. It feels like you have equal parts pushing against each other of like crazy creative designs versus like your engineer brain that's based in reality. Is that hard to grapple with? Do you have to like walk yourself back a lot?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I haven't really thought about this. It is kind of odd that like I notice this sometimes where I'll come up with it, like the Lotus that, you know, in my mind, it's like, oh, you get the car, you do the 3D scan it. You like 3D scan the motors. You figure out where to package stuff, put it together. Boom, you're done. But I know, like I've done enough projects to know that it's going to be so many shitty details and like so much like stuff that I'm not thinking about. What am I going to do with the cooling system? How am I going to keep everything in the right temperature? You know, but I guess I've done stuff like this for long enough that I know I'll be able to figure it out. So I don't worry about that stuff too much.
Do you ever like, do your friends come over and help you out?
Oh yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I got a bunch of friends that, kind of, one of the engineering friends that
they work for beer.
Yeah. Usually. Yeah. Usually dinner. I'm lucky enough to have friends who have, free time for various reasons.
And that's great.
They just kind of like want to, you know, help out with a cool project. So
yeah,
I try not to like, I'm a little careful to not like, If something just sucks, like doing a bunch of sanding or whatever, I'm like, I'll take care of that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to. Yeah. But yeah, it's mostly just friends.
You're a wealthy man in that respect.
Yeah.
I always, you know, I go through periods where I have those, you know, lots of free time and friends with free time too. And it just feels like you're getting away with something. We're like, how? What? Like,
yeah,
they're just willing to come over on a Tuesday and do this with me, and
yeah.
It feels like a cheat code where you're like, this shouldn't be.
Yeah. But I get it because I have friends that I help out. You know, like,
yeah.
I don't know if you know Robin Shute. He does Pikes Peak hill climb stuff. Mm-hmm. He just beat the rear wheel drive record.
Yeah, with the not the Advan livery car, right?
It
looks like a
formula. It's the Yokohama.
Yes. That car is sick.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So I helped him out with a bunch of that.
Yeah.
He helps me out with stuff. So
I can't believe that crash was at Laguna Seca.
Yeah.
Just took off. But he was all right, right?
He had a couple of fractured things here and there. God. He was a little bit of a rebound, but I think he's pretty much back to normal.
It looks brutal.
Yeah. He thinks that, I hope I'm not giving away something he hasn't announced yet, but he thinks that based on the data that he like flew farther than any car has ever jumped before.
No way.
Yeah.
Even like, further than that, like Mercedes.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So he needs to make a video on this. But weirdly there was cameras everywhere and he had four cameras on his car,
yeah.
But nobody got an outside view of So nobody really knows. But you can like look at the video and you can look at the data. And what happened was his front wing broke off, and then it like basically his front tires drove over the front wing. So it kicked the front off.
Oh my God.
So he has open wheels in the front, but closed wheels in the back. And that Mercedes is all closed wheel. Yeah. Right? So it went up and then it just immediately flipped over. But he had open wheels in the front. So it kind of just like,
it did like a ski jump kind of thing.
Yeah. And then came back down. Yeah. Ski jump. That's a good way to put it. Came back down and hit the wall. But yeah, I saw that car. I saw the pile of wreckage that was that car. It's kind of a bummer because that was, you know, that was a very expensive car that is now worth $0.
Hours of engineering and building and stuff.
It's like I looked at it and like every single component I looked at was broken. I'm like, there is nothing left here.
Nothing to salvage.
Nothing.
Yeah. So you're super into land speed stuff. Have you ever thought about like, you know, with your engineering background and your propensity to, you know, 3D print parts and aero and stuff like that. Have you ever thought of Pikes Peak or any kind of hill climb stuff?
I mean, I think I would like to have more time to do some sort of like, I don't know about Pikes Peak. Actually, I talked to Robin about this. We had this conversation not too long ago about my thought was like, what's the slowest record that's, you know, cause like, I don't want to go full tilt there.
Yeah.
But it would be cool to do. Like the thing about car projects with me is I'm in it for the project.
Yeah.
Like I want the build. Like the car's got to be there.
It's not like the record or the thrill of racing it that drives you.
Yeah. So like with land speed racing, with any racing, this is true. But with land speed, it's especially true. For every 1 second that I'm in the car at speed is like 50 hours of building and fixing and engineering and sanding and towing and all this stuff. So. I mean, Pikes Peak is cool because it's like, I think the cool thing about land speed racing and Pikes Peak is that if you get into the unlimited class, there are no rules. There's safety rules.
Yeah.
But like beyond that, you can kind of do whatever you want. So I think, I don't know if I would build a Pikes Peak car because that's like all the complexity of land speed car. Plus also you're turning left and right. You can generate downforce and not just drag it. It's like, I don't know, man.
And dealing with altitude and all that stuff.
Yeah, you have to be a better driver than I am for sure. Yeah.
We interviewed Scott Birdsall a while ago. I don't know if you're familiar.
Mm-hmm. But I met him. He's a nice guy.
He has been going for like diesel truck records. Mm-hmm. And he had a crazy crash at Pikes Peak a while ago with his...
I did a video on Pikes Peak that year. And I talked about the diesel record because there's three people that were going after it that year. And it was crunching to get the video out in time. And I didn't know like any of the details. I didn't want to add anything into that video about the crash. Cause I didn't know any of the details. It looked really rough.
It was super rough. And he just walked away from it. He did hurt himself, but it was crawling out and he twisted his ankle on a rock trying to tell the medics like I'm cool. but I feel like diesel truck record could be beat. You know, like that.
Maybe the outright diesel record I know is really difficult because that was a really interesting race because he had it. It was between him and this guy, Grégoire Blechon, who has this really cool setup where he's got three turbos on a sports car type thing with a Volkswagen diesel with three turbos. And he's using cylinder pressure sensors and then turbo speed sensors. And then he's got valves between the turbos set up to where basically he's just maximizing cylinder pressure all the time by varying which turbo the exhaust goes to make sure they're all spooled up to where he's like constantly. Yeah, it's a
super they're awesome. All separate. It's not sequential, is it?
I don't remember the exact layout. But it's the kind of thing where he put a lot of thought into it.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Dude, diesel guys are crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Pikes Peak is cool. I think that's, I don't know if I'd ever build a car, but I would actually love to get like I would love to drive Pikes Peak in a production based car or something. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Give me a Clio. I'll take it up. It's funny. I talked to Robin about this. I don't know if I could race Pike's Peak, because like I could drive up at 7/10, but there's no way I could do it at 10/10 because there's no barriers. There's like the crappy little metal barriers and
the visibility and is horrible because you're going up
100, 156, something like that corners. And there's a few that there's like one in particular that is kind of notorious for Peak because it looks going into it exactly like another corner that has a nice sweeper out of it, but it's like a tight corner and people get it confused and fly into the trees. Anyway, I was like, I don't think I could do it at 10/10. And Robin says, he says, nobody does it at 10/10. The trick is making your 7/10 faster than the next guy's. Think about that. But yeah.
Yeah. There's just the gnarly crashes are what would keep me away from doing any sort of record. Record setting. I don't even really drive that much. I want to go back to what you mentioned before, because I have a question about building your own plane. Is there any kind of feasibility about Tesla swapping a plane, or like, are there electric planes? I don't even know.
There are, but like you really need the energy density of fuel, like the amount of power density that you get out of fuel versus a lithium ion battery. I think there's like probably, you could do something like where if you had an electric motor up there and then you had, a relatively small battery and then you had an internal combustion engine that did nothing but generate electricity for that battery.
Yeah. Because you don't want to be assed out and have like 1% up in the air.
yeah. But I don't know, man. I think that like airplanes just have to be so lightweight.
Yeah.
That you just, the benefit you get from the energy density of fuel is hard to beat.
Yeah, that's true. I'm petrified of planes. I'm never going to.
Yeah.
Never going to. My wife has her... Cessna license. I don't know if that's the correct term, but
yeah, private license.
She told me the story about this. She would like during the pandemic, she would just bop around Mexico, like stay in little villages here and there and fly out with her ex. And at one point they had like flown into the super sketchy, high altitude, small runway, airport, stayed for a couple days. And I think they took on another person when they were leaving. They're like going to give him a ride or something. So they were like at their weight limit. The ex said that he had done his math about it and that they were fine. But it was like, when it's cold, it's bad to take off, right? Or when it's hot.
It was hot.
When it's hot. So it was hot. It was bad conditions and they were overweight. And she said that they missed the fence at the end by like a foot.
Yeah. It's just bad preparation.
Yeah. Horrible.
Yeah.
But
that shouldn't happen. That's like there's key things you got to do before you take off. And one of them is understanding density, altitude, and the weight of the plane and all that stuff. Yeah.
But apparently her ex was not that great of a pilot. So that story has single-handedly kept me away from.
It's interesting to look at the fatalities for airplanes because it's like it's the same thing with motorcycles. Like, all right, there are like three things that you can do on a motorcycle to cut your chance of serious injury in half, right? Like wear a helmet, don't drink and ride.
And leathers and...
Yeah, and then like if in your first year of riding, just like that's when you need to sort of be super careful and, and then people turning left in front of you, stuff like that.
You have no control over that,
though. Yeah, well, you kind of do. If you're aware of it,
you
be a little like...
Drive defensively.
Flash the high beams or something. But like with an airplane, with airplanes, it's kind of the same thing. You look at... you're talking about like the Tesla swapping. People love to... take Volkswagen engines and throw them into old airplanes.
Oh God.
And then that there's like, you can do it, but like the crash and fatality rates go way up.
Holy shit.
Cause like there's, you now have a thrust load on your main bearing, right? Cause you're pulling forward with the propeller. All right. Yeah. Maybe you can mitigate that, but it's like, there's a lot of weird stuff about the harmonics of the engine. And if you start getting a weird vibration that the engine it was built for doesn't have. Yeah. And then you have these like little tubes going off to hold the engine, or like maybe one of them, you just like, just rerun the mounts to the engine, but now you've got a weird cantilever. So
sure.
And then if your engine mount cracks and your engine falls off, you're f***ed because now your center of mass is behind your wings and you don't have any control surfaces. You just tumbled down. So it's like, I don't know. Don't do like this is the part of the reason I think it would be interesting to build an airplane is because I'm the kind of guy who does stuff like that. I'm the kind of guy that takes a Volkswagen engine and shoves it in an airplane where like, I'm just like, let's do this crazy thing that nobody's done before. That is like kind of goofy. But I know you got to be really careful with an airplane with that sure. sort of stuff. You got to like really know. And so I kind of like the idea of it because it sort of will force me to think about things in a different way.
Yeah, where it's like hypercritical, where one little mistake is the end of your life.
yeah. It's fun, like, because I got a couple of friends with planes, and it's fun looking at, like, you know, helping them fix things, or just like you take the seats out and you look at everything, and you're like, there are like 100 single point failures that would result in a really bad day. There's so many things that like have to work.
Yeah.
You just got to make sure they work.
And it's crazy that you know, it's pretty regulated, you know, like a lot of.
It, kind of. So there's like the certified aircraft, which are very regulated and have lots of, I think, too many rules, actually. It's kind of crazy. Like if you buy a 72 Cessna or whatever, you want to change the landing light, you have to use this exact landing light that is this crappy halogen that costs too much money.
Oh,
and
really? Burns.
Whereas like if you build your own plane and you stick the experimental sticker on there, you can fly a shopping cart. You can do basically anything.
What?
Yeah. I mean, there's like some basic airworthiness, but like the certified aircraft, I think they go a little too far with requiring, like not allowing any minor changes.
It's too regulated.
Yeah. Experimental is like basically completely unregulated. It's basically too far to the other side.
Does it result in less airports that you can land? Or like, what would be the point of not being, you know, putting the experimental sticker on your...
You can't convert a plane that is not experimental to, but you have to build it from the ground up.
Okay.
But like, yeah. And you can't, I think you can't like do things for hire without a certified aircraft.
That makes sense. Can't be commercial purposes.
Yeah. There's some other stuff too. But like, if I built something, it would be experimental for sure.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
So what, give me some dream specs of your experimental aircraft.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd kind of like something like a little bit of a bush plane to where I could land out in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
Because I like being out in the middle of nowhere.
And so like, it needs to be able to land and take off in a pretty short area.
Yeah. And in pretty rough area. So big wheels,
big
rubber tires.
And would you 3D print all the parts for this?
Probably not. yeah. I mean, I'd probably buy a kit. And I would think there's some stuff that I would probably change and modify and whatnot here and there. But it'd probably be a lot of 3D printing for sure. But yeah, mostly.
You are like so good at, you use the bamboo 3D printers. And I'm just amazed at like the scale of things that you're able to make.
Yeah, we made the body for Robin's race car.
Yeah.
3D printed.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So one of the videos I get asked to make the most often is how to use CAD. And I haven't done the video yet because I've been using CAD for so long that I think that there's stuff that I think is intuitive that is not, or
yeah.
I don't think I'm the best person to do it, but I kind of want to do it because there's so many things that I do that you really need to know CAD to open up the possibilities. And you can do a lot of stuff with a 3D printer without knowing CAD, but man, as soon as you're good at CAD, holy shit, you can do anything.
Just expands the world.
It's magical.
Yeah. That's awesome. I would love to have the time to be able to dive into that. What is the program called that you use?
I use Fusion.
Fusion. Okay.
Yeah. There's a few different ones. I think Fusion's probably the best right now for like, small hobbyist type stuff.
Yeah. Are you sponsored by Bamboo?
I'm sponsored by Bamboo. Yeah.
That's cool. Hell yeah.
Yeah. They're actually one of my best sponsors, partly because they make like that. I hated 3D printers for years because I used them 20 years ago, 15 years ago. It was really hard to get something to actually print.
Yeah.
And then when you got it to actually print, it would be weak and fall apart. And then,
I didn't even realize that they existed 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. We had one at school. One of the professors had a SLA machine that would make garbage basically. And then even
Funko
like
Pops.
Yeah, like 15-ish years ago, there was like the MakerBot replicator and some other stuff that was just not very good. And then like 2 or 3 years ago, Bamboo was just it's interesting to look at it because it sort of pulled in all of these people who like to make things, obviously, but also these people who are kind of like, I use the word nerd not really disparagingly, but like people who like to nerd out on stuff.
Sure.
And so all these printers, you could like modify and change and expand and change the different parts. And sort of like, the companies that were making them catered to this community of like free and open source people who like to modify and like to do all that stuff. Well, the result of that is like all, most of those printers were kind of like, you can't, there's like, there's always a, it is whenever you add capability, modifiability like that, you sort of take away the easy user experience. You can't really have both. And Bamboo came out and they're like, we're going to make a toaster. We're going to make something that is a appliance that just kind of works well. And you don't have to be that nerd.
Yeah.
And it, yeah, I was like, thank God. I don't want to, mess up with this. So I got it. And it's interesting. I have this weird problem right now where Bamboo as a company likes to, they're very closed, very closed source, very walled garden, kind of like Apple. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of friction between the old school 3D printer, free and open source people and Bamboo. And I still like Bamboo and I still sponsor them, but I get a lot of like negative comments because Bamboo every once in a while will come out and like piss off the community by doing one thing or another. And I'm like, shit. God damn it. Like, so, but I don't know. It's, I think the printers they make are amazing. They really have changed the way that I make things.
They're super sleek. And I just like from an outside perspective, someone who doesn't know anything about 3D printing, they look very accessible to someone like me who doesn't know shit.
You know?
It feels like I could just make, like you were saying, just like anything, pop it in the toaster and it's done.
Yeah. It's not exactly toaster level, but it's amazing.
Sure. Close. Yeah. As someone who represents a company like that, does it feel weird being the middleman when that kind of pushback happens? Like, do you feel the need to explain, or do you kind of just stay out of it?
I kind of stay out of it. You know, anytime anything happens with a company that I'm sponsored by or supported by, I'm always like, you know, let's take a look at it and think about how this, but like, I don't think it's really my responsibility to fix that. And I don't think frankly, the free and open source community is they're a little overreactionary.
Sure.
They're very vocal.
No, an online community.
Yeah.
Over vocal. That's crazy.
And I think a lot of the stuff that, they get upset about is like, you just give it a week. People will calm down. It's not that bad, but, it does suck to be stuck in the middle of that where like, you know, it sucks to have people. I like reading my comments. I read most of my comments and I have pretty good commenters. But whenever I put up a video and then like whenever something happens where there's a lot of negative comments about like, you should be better than this or whatever, I'm just like, fucking, I'm not going to read these comments.
Yeah.
I hate that. Cause I want to read them, you know,
sure.
I want to interact with the community.
It is a vocal minority though.
If
that makes you feel any better. It's a lot of people with too much time and too much, you know, attention to detail where it's like, really, this is the hell you're going to die on.
But that's like, you know, the cool thing about YouTube is everybody can leave their comment and a lot of people feel a certain way, you'll get a lot of those comments and it's like, all right, well, that's the way this is going.
Yeah. It feels like you have a very supportive fan base too, that kind of will trust whatever you do.
Yeah. Yeah. I have actually an awesome fan base because I can put up a video about anything and pretty much guarantee 250,000 views. I think I look at a lot of people who have, there's a lot of people who have like 3 or 4 times as many subscribers as I have, and they'll have hits here and there, but they're averaging like 50,000 views a video.
Yeah.
I haven't had a 50,000 view video in 5 years. Like I can put up anything and get 250,000 views.
That's awesome.
Which is great. But also that comes with a responsibility in the back of my mind to not put up shit videos.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's cool. That's the fans are holding you to a standard where,
yeah,
you feel like you have to hit. I think that's a healthy thing. It's when the fans demand stuff where you're not comfortable doing, you know, on a consistent clip, I think is when things get tough and you get burnt out and stuff where it's like, you feel like you have to keep one upping yourself. Whereas the stuff that you do is so all over the board that people aren't like, make a land speed car that goes twice as fast, because you're known for other stuff other than being this land speed guy.
Yeah. I think this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with like, I quit a pretty good engineering career to do this YouTube thing. I'm not going to It's not going to become a job, a boring job for me. And I kind of just make videos about whatever I think is interesting in the moment. And frankly, it's entirely possible that 10 years from now, my channel will be about golf or something. Like it's going to be about whatever I'm interested
in.
And you know, I'll put up videos from time to time that's like a different than what I normally just like, not a, usually if I put up the garage build videos, that's like the core. But then I'll put up like I'll do a review of a electric motorcycle or something. And I'll get a lot of comments. People are like, I don't like this type of video. You need to go back to your old type.
Okay.
Hey man, too bad. Yeah. Like I'm going to make this, I want to make this video. So I'm going to make it.
Yeah. That's a great mindset.
But I think that there's something to be learned from that in that, like I can do that and I still get the core audience showing up. So it's like, okay, maybe I think there's too many of these like tips and tricks and things that people try to do to try to like get the viewer, just make a, if you like the video, if you're interested in the thing the video is about and you make it and you watch it, you're like, yeah, that's a good video. Boom. That's all you got to do. Just do that.
Well, you have to have good taste like you do.
Yeah. I
suppose. It doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, but I think if you're genuinely interested.
Sure.
And you're genuinely entertained by what you make or somebody's going to like it. I don't know. I guess maybe I'm making it sound easier than it is, but
no, I think that's what drew me to your channel in the first place was it was first the title. It was like my type of humor where it's that dry kind of snark. And I'm like, oh, that's funny. I'll click on it. And then your voice was immediately so identifiable and relatable where I'm like, oh, I feel like I know this guy. And then that carried through to every one of your videos. You weren't trying to pander to anyone. You weren't trying to like, it's unk here again, you know, not trying to like Gen Z it up or whatever. You're very much like comfortable with who you are and what you like. And I think that comes through very strong in your channel. And I think that's why people watch and subscribe to you. So
thanks.
If that outside perspective helps at all reaffirm, you know, what you're doing, I think you're on the right track. You know, I think like it's only a matter of time before you just, your channel doubles in size and you feel like just keep doing what you're doing, man. I don't know where I was going with this, but I really appreciate your channel. I love like whenever a new video drops, I'm like, I'm looking forward to it. I'm clicking on it right away. And I'm looking forward to, you know, what you have planned in the future. So
cool. Yeah,
I think we're out of time. Sorry, I rambled on for the last 5 minutes, but Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Joe.
And I hope we can continue to do more cool stuff together.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I like helping you guys out with stuff.
Follow Superfast Matt on YouTube, but also what's your handle on Instagram?
Superfast Matt on Instagram.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's where to find me. That's all I'm doing.
Very easy. Well, like and subscribe and follow his channel. Also, our channel as well. We have videos every week. And thank you for listening. I've been Joe Weber, and we'll see you next time.